Hello, and welcome to The Thin End of the Wedge, the podcast where experts from around the world share new and interesting stories about life in the ancient Middle East. My name's John. Each episode, I talk to friends and colleagues and get them to explain their work in a way we can all understand. Before we go any further, I'd like to welcome a new voice to the podcast.
Hi, my name is Ellie Bennett, and I am the new co-host of Thin End of the Wedge. I am based at the University of Helsinki, and I am an Assyriologist. I'm interested in a bunch of stuff, but mostly gender studies. I'm interested in digital methods, and at the moment, I'm researching emotions in ancient Middle Eastern texts. And I'm really excited to be part of this project, really excited to be on this podcast, and can't wait to talk to so many interesting researchers about their fascinating work. What is gender? This question sounds like it has an easy answer. Gender is what makes a man and a woman, right? However, ask any researcher of gender in the ancient Middle East the same question, and you get a much more complicated answer. Over the decades, gender has become an important topic in studying the ancient Middle East, and it has become clear that what makes a woman or a man is very different across these ancient cultures. Our guest today is organizing an important conference called Gender and Methodology in the Ancient Near East in April. Since it began in 2014, it has become one of the most important congregations of researchers in gender in the ancient Middle East. And the publications that come out of it have become valuable starting points for many young scholars interested in the field. We wanted to chat with our guest and find out why research into gender in the ancient Middle East is so important, as well as the current trends of the field and what he thinks its future holds. So get yourself a cup of tea, make yourself comfortable, and let's meet today's guest. So hi, Omar. Could you tell us who you are and what it is you do?
Hello. My name is Omar Anshay, and I'm the director of the International School for Foundation Studies at the University of Malta. My research interests are in the Assyrian Empire, with a particular focus on gender in general and masculinities in particular. I write in both English and Maltese, and I'm involved in both academic research as well as outreach writing.
Why do you focus on gender? What do you think we can learn from studying gender in the ancient Near East?
The study of gender is important primarily because it was actually a very important aspect of the ancient societies that we study. The gender identity of human and non-human beings was an aspect of identity that actually mattered, and that resulted in very specific social, political, artistic, literary, cultic, architectural, as well as cultural organization, as well as a broad range of gender-specific bodily practices that were considered to be normative or non-normative in ancient societies. The study of gender can help us make sense of these culture-specific practices, and therefore leaving gender outside of the research agenda and the writing of history and prehistory would mean leaving such aspects unaddressed. There is really nothing new about the study of gender in the ancient Near East, because early scholarship already dealt quite extensively with matters related to sex and gender, and it is not at all uncommon to find reference to such matters. Layard, for example, was already writing about eunuchs and the effective response of the people working at the sites where the reliefs showing these beardless officials were recovered. Women, royal or otherwise, were also written about. In the sense, I don't really think that ancient Near Eastern scholars were lagging far behind their colleagues in adjacent scholarly disciplines and their endeavors, even though that is often the perception. Think, for example, of Julia Asher Greb's work in the 1980s on women in Sumer, and Julian Reed's wonderful study asking, perhaps a bit playfully, whether evidence suggests that Sennacherib was a feminist. We also have John Westenholt's review of the proceedings of the 33rd Rencontre. And then in the 1990s, the introduction of the study of masculinities by Irene Winter in her work on the masculinity of Gudea. And then later on, in the very popular essay on sex and gender and the victory stele of Naram Sin, and Megan Cifarelli on how gender constructs and visual syntax employed, for example, at the court of the Assyrian king Ashurnasirpal II, were used to produce the optics of alterity and otherness. So to come back to the question, I think studying gender helps us to make sense of these social, political, artistic, literary, et cetera, norms and non-norms that we have in our record.
Wonderful. You make reference to some really important studies in gender in the ancient Near East. But what are some of the current trends that you have seen in this really important topic?
Well, I think that at the heart of current projects that use gender as a tool with which to think and with which to ask questions of the ancient source material is the notion that gender is marked. This means that gender is defined heuristically and methodologically. Past scholarship left a lot of assumptions in place about sex and gender and left them unaddressed. And therefore, the descriptions and analyses often repeated the stereotypes that were circulating, that were around. But the problem is that when we actually look at the data sets with a gender framework of analysis, we realize that those stereotypes do not actually hold any weight. Zeynep Bahrani, for example, did a wonderful job, and for many, a very inspiring job. For many people using gender as a tool of analysis in the ancient Near East, this was a very inspiring work by starting to elaborate a framework for the study of women in ancient Mesopotamia in the book Women of Babylon. More recently, Martin Nissanen, for example, made it very clear, this was about a decade ago, that we need methodologies that are born out of our data sets and not methodologies developed from other source material and then sort of applied uncritically in astrology. Nissanen was specifically referring to the study of masculinities in Mesopotamia, but the argument is applicable to other genders as well. The study of gender is, of course, tied to the wider world of theory and methodology, and in a sense, it is also deeply influenced by it. So some scholars continue to write about gender from strictly essentialist perspectives, whereas others seek to problematize that position by going to the sources to indicate that some evidence suggests that already in the ancient record, gender was seen as a lot more malleable, so existing on a spectrum, and that the view of two genders is too reductive to be an accurate reflection of what the sources say. In this field, we're also seeing a renewed interest in the materiality of the body, which for a long while, actually had gone out of fashion, partly because it didn't serve the advocacy of the social construction school of thought at the outset. Now, those who adhere to the social construction school of thought are complicating this by reevaluating the theoretical work of Michel Foucault, for example, and Judith Butler in light of the sources that we have and emerging issues and debates. Also, among scholars of the ancient Near East, as well as among some of my students, we are witnessing some of the more interesting discussions that are coming out of the strengths and the tensions at play when we cross queer theory with trans scholarship, particularly when we're talking about figures in our record like the Asinu, the Kurgaru. I think most of us are actually looking forward to having more of these discussions and to seeing what the ancient record can actually tell us about these matters.
You've been really, really careful to not limit your answers to talking about Near Eastern women or ancient Middle Eastern women. And I'm wondering if that is reflective of the field as a whole. Does studying gender in ancient Near Eastern sources and ancient Middle Eastern texts or art or archaeology mean that you have to look at women? Or do you feel like it's pretty representative of the field to say that you're looking beyond it? And could you explain why we would want to look at not just women when looking at gender?
Mm-hmm. There was a time when the study of gender meant the study of women only. And for many people, scholars and non-scholars alike, only women had a gender. Men did not, because men were considered to be universal. Men were universal. At that point, sex and gender, or at least the way the terms are used in the English language and in anglophonic research agendas, the two notions, sex and gender, seemed synonymous for many, partly because they were tied to the notion of difference. At that point, research focused on revealing the androcentric assumptions of the literature being produced about the past, as well as the lack of equity in academia, in archaeological excavations, for example. Nowadays, for instance, with my students, things have really changed. They've changed in the scholarship, but also particularly it's gone down, it's percolated, it's trickled down to even the classrooms. If we talk about women in the ancient Near East, they tend to assume that what we're doing is feminist readings or feminist interpretations. Whereas if we talk about non-binary persons or trans persons, that we're doing gender. In this sense, therefore, it's as if things have now shifted and only non-binary or trans persons are gendered. And this is also not quite accurate and not right. Gender really is about people primarily. And increasingly, we are seeing an interest in using gender as an analytical tool to talk about non-human persons as well, to talk about gender and materiality, for example. At a recent scholarship on the materialities of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, which was hosted by La Sapienza University in Rome and organized by Lorenzo Verderame and Davide Nadali, I've tried to combine a new materialities approach with gender. And it seems like our sources can afford us a rich avenue of research. So we have moved well beyond one particular gender to represent all the genders that we have in our data sets. The problem is that for some people, we continue to mark gender only for some subjectivities and not for all subjectivities, or to even resist taking gender beyond human bodies into non-human persons and into non-human materiality.
Hmm. Can we turn to those men then? What do you think are the key components of being a man in Assyria during the Neo-Assyrian Empire? Do you think they're very different from the expectations of being a man today? If we were able to visit Nineveh, or if an Assyrian were to walk down the street in Valletta, what degree of culture shock would there be?
Right. John, perhaps this is a good opportunity to apply what we have been talking about up to now. Obviously, such a question for us cannot have a straight answer, because if we define gender heuristically, either as a cultural discourse and a bodily practice that is attached to a particular body type, or as the feeling that is situated in the body or elsewhere in our being, vis-a-vis our being in the world and our entanglement with everyone and everything around us, then we would never come up with a single universal answer of what it means to be a man. I mean, I think at this point, even Orthodox essentialists will tell you that there is no one way of being a man or a woman, for example. In this sense, therefore, there was no one way of being a man in the Neo-Assyrian period of Assyrian history, in the same way that there is no one way of being a man anywhere in the world right now, no matter how culturally specific we get. This is because in cases where we talk of universals, those universals are usually somewhat artificial, and they exclude or gloss over nuances that would be theoretically inconvenient. What I would say, however, is that an honest research answer would tell you that, for example, a Neo-Assyrian king was one type of man in the royal inscriptions, but a somewhat different man in the visual culture of the palace on the reliefs, and a rather different man in the letters written to his scholars. And a totally unrecognizable type from all of these in the letters written to and from the royal physician. And to complicate this even further, the king was a different man in different stages of his life, with different people and in different life circumstances. And if we wish to elaborate this even further, we could say that different kings expressed different understandings of masculinities and therefore performed and lived out their manhood differently. Sennacherib's way of being a man, for example, was enormously different to Ashurnasirpal II's expression of manhood. Sennacherib's notion of masculinity was rooted in the idea of statesmanship, and his military masculinity was downplayed in the visual culture of the palace. The royal inscriptions continued the military masculinity of the state and of the ruler, but the visual culture allowed for a different view of his gender expression. Esarhaddon's ways of being a man are very complex because they intersect with various pathologies, somatic and psychosomatic. And then there is the view from the outside. Often we get the hegemonic view of masculinity from the criticisms leveled against our past actors for failing to do this or for failing to do that. In Assyria, militarized masculinity was to be found everywhere, however, in the human body, in the structures that came to dominate the state, and in the materialities of the empire. Its discourse came to serve a very useful function for its territorial ambitions, and it gave the Assyrians an effective discourse that was aligned with their rationale of rule. So I think that when we're asking questions like, you know, what was it like to be a man in this particular period or that particular period, I think we've got to be careful, first of all, about the media in which that type of manhood is being represented. Because as we see in the Neo-Assyrian Empire, for example, the visual culture is disseminating one form of being a man, whereas the textual culture seems to be a lot more conservative of certain notions of gender than the visual culture is. The letters afford us a completely different view. At times, we even get a glimpse of affect or, you know, the personal circumstances that give rise to certain emotions. When we compare these readings together, we realize that different media are constructing different notions of manhood and masculinity for the period.
Moving a little bit away from the king of Assyria, I was wondering about this really interesting group, which we normally refer to as eunuchs. Do you see the same kinds of nuances in the different source material for eunuchs, or are they universally seen and depicted the same way across the material?
So, Ellie, thank you for this question. One of my main research interests is this class of persons that we refer to as eunuchs. These persons are referred to as Sha-Reshi in the ancient record. Not everyone in Assyriology and ancient Near Eastern history agrees that these people were castrated men. In fact, there's a very lively debate going on. In a way, lively, yes, but in a way, this debate on whether the Sha-Reshi was actually referred to castrated men or not has in a way stopped or slowed down the advancement of the study of eunuchism in the Assyrian Empire. But let's, for the sake of convenience, call these two groups the minimalists and the maximalists. Those who refused the claim in its entirety and those for whom all Sha-Reshi were castrated males, because that is what the term means for them, eunuch. My interest is in this class of people in the middle and in the Neo-Assyrian periods, particularly their metropolitan urban identities. I belong, in a way, to the maximalist school of thought, but I do read the minimalists very, very carefully and very closely. In the Middle Assyrian period, for example, we don't have much literature, much secondary literature, or we don't have any studies, really, that make reference to eunuchs or eunuchism in the Middle Assyrian period. But the data sets are quite interesting. So in the Middle Assyrian period, eunuchs are referred to in the palace decrees, the so-called, unfortunately so-called, harem edicts. We have a problem in gender studies particularly. We have a problem with the word harem or harim because there's a lot of retrojection and a lot of Orientalism in the term. So let's just call this group of texts the palace decrees. They're referred to in the palace decrees and in these texts as a consequence of their body modification. These people are employed to give or deny access to people to specific areas in the women's quarters. But beyond the palace decrees, there are also a lot of other documents which clearly indicate that these eunuchs were doing other things in the metropolitan areas. For example, they were employed as kepo officials in charge of the crown's stores of grain. They were trading, dealing in barley and grain, especially selling to bird feeders and millers. They were in charge of the food provisions for the troops, for Assyrian troops and captive troops. They were overseeing the building of cities, of fortification walls. They were also involved in the procurement of fabric, of wood, of wool, of gold and perfume. In the Middle Assyrian period, we also have enough information about particular individuals whose biographies, short but interesting biographies, we can start drafting or we can start writing. Also in the Middle Assyrian period, castration is seen also as a punitive measure. There are two laws in particular that are based on the notion of lex talionis, that is an eye for an eye scenario, in which we see a grim symmetry of punishment, if you want. In one of them, a male adulterer would be punished by being turned into a shareshi, while in the other, the penetrator in a man-to-man sex act between two social equals is likewise punished by castration. I'm imagining this to be a case of non-consensual sex between two male equals. In the Neo-Assyrian period, things get even better for eunuchs, and they become very central figures at the royal court. They take on every duty imaginable and are often seen leading campaigns and referred to as worthy men and mighty soldiers. We see entire processions of eunuchs at Dur-Sharrukan, Sargon II's palace in Khorsabad, but for some reason they seem to vanish during the reign of Sennacherib, only to come back in the reigns of Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal. Some queries to the sun god reveal in this period a certain fear or paranoia that the eunuchs might conspire against the king and to try to seize the crown. However, when we compare this period to later periods, for example, particularly in the classical period, we notice one thing in particular, that eunuchs are never referred to in negative light, in negative terms, gender or otherwise. In later periods, they become repudiated, but also desirable subjects at the same time. But to be fair, a eunuch does take the throne of Assyria towards the last days of the empire, but this reign was really short-lived. And it was actually the reign that might have given some really good material to the later criticism of Ashurbanipal's effeminate rule, the so-called effeminate rule. The negative gendering of eunuchs, however, is not an Assyrian thing at all. And in fact, some of the studies that try to portray Assyrian eunuchs as either liminally gendered or as non-binary gendered or as third gendered individuals will have to deal with the fact that there is nothing in the Assyrian record to indicate that they were referred to in any other term but a strictly militarized masculine man. At some point in the Assyrian sequence, eunuchism became a very useful tool for this sort of imperial ambition to maintain the holdings away from the center. The dependence of the Neo-Assyrian period and the dependence of Neo-Assyrian kings on a fully functioning provincial system created the need for a figure, an individual, that did not create problems of succession. It was at this point that eunuchs were employed as provincial governors. And for example, in the correspondence of Sennacherib and the correspondence of Sargon in particular, as well as in the correspondence of Tiglath-Pileser III, we see that many people, many of the individuals working as provincial governors were actually eunuchs. We have a lot of information. Currently, I'm working on a monograph to try and bring all the information together to try and figure out the networks that were being created, who were the individuals, you know, what they were writing to each other, their roles as provincial governors. But for example, in the reign of Sargon, most of the provincial governors were actually eunuchs. They were referred to as shareshi. And at one point, we even have references of areas where these shareshi lived and where they were sourced from. We know very, very little about their background, partly because becoming shareshi involved the erasure of a past, because then you became subject of the crown.
Absolutely fascinating. And you're clearly very busy pumping out research about gender, about masculinities, about this fascinating group of eunuchs. But that's not all. You're also organizing a conference in April. Can you tell us more about it and what you're most looking forward to?
Right. Yes, I'm very excited that we are organizing the sixth iteration of the Gender, Methodology and Ancient Near East Conference. The sixth iteration is going to take place at the University of Malta, the Valletta campus. It will be held from the 8th to the 11th of April of 2024 this year. And we have four full days of fascinating papers. It's an international conference. There are scholars coming from everywhere. The Gender, Methodology and Ancient Near East Conference is known in the community as GEMANE. Some people say GEMANE. We still haven't really agreed on the proper pronunciation for this, which is fine. I'm co-organizing this with my colleague here in Malta, with Dennis Mitzi, but also with Ellie Bennett, with Sana Svard, with Megan Cifarelli and Agnes Garcia Ventura. We have a number of different sessions, so we hit on a lot of subjects. There are some really fascinating contributions. This year, particularly, we have a whole session on Unix. We also have a whole session on cultic practice. And we also have some fascinating papers that are coming from outside Mesopotamia proper. So Urosh Matic will be talking about the gender in ancient Egypt, for example. We have some Phoenician Punic studies. We have biblical scholarship as well. So we understand the Near East, the ancient Near East, in the broadest way possible. Germane or Germane has always given us a really strong sense of community and an enormously safe space in which we can use the rigors of academia, but also to talk openly and to discuss in a really friendly way some of the most challenging aspects of studying gender, particularly the methodologies that we employ, particularly methodologies that are born out of our data sets. So we've continuously been problematizing the idea of taking existing methodologies that are used elsewhere and then importing them lock, stock, barrel to our data sets. And so we're seeing more and more methodologies that are coming out of the data sets that are relevant to ancient Mesopotamia, specifically the ancient Near East in general, but also ancient Egypt. I'm particularly looking forward to a business dinner that we have one evening of the conference. Over here, we will be talking openly in the entire gender methodology and ancient Near East community on the future of this workshop, of these conferences. We are interested in talking about, for example, the modalities of the workshop itself, whether to have parallel sessions or to continue having non-parallel sessions to ensure that everybody gets to listen to everybody's papers. We are also very much interested in the creation of a scientific committee and also of a general committee for the workshop and for the conference, as well as identifying future venues for this conference to take place.
Brilliant, thank you. I wonder if we could turn a little bit now more towards you and your own context, as it were. So you're based in Malta, which isn't one of the traditional big centers of Assyriology. So I was wondering, first of all, how did you become interested in this topic? And what is the state of Assyriology in Malta today?
Thank you, John. Yes, exactly. One is a little bit isolated when doing Assyriology in Malta, in a sense, but I get the feeling nowadays more and more so that one is always isolated wherever one does decide to do Assyriology. So I think this is only possible. I think it's only possible to do Assyriology in Malta now because of the ease of travel. We are very well connected to most European cities now, so travel has become a lot easier. But also to the generosity of people who are not so isolated and people who have access to resources and sources away from the island and who can send things over very, very easily. And so the exchange of information has become a lot easier. So I think one can do Assyriology wherever really now. So that's really interesting. I came to it because I did ancient Near Eastern studies at the university. We have a department of Middle Eastern and Asian languages and cultures. And it's a wonderful department. And we've had Near Eastern studies for a very, very long time. And this is where I came from. I come from archaeology and Near Eastern studies. I originally studied Hebrew and Arabic. But also in the archaeology classes, I did Phoenician, Punic, and Aramaic. I remember we had a language component. We had a language study unit that was an elective, and you could choose whichever language you wanted. And I did my project on Akkadian, and I haven't looked back since. My professor had studied Akkadian in Rome. He's a biblical scholar. So we have a strong tradition of biblical scholarship here, and also the wider biblical world. And I sort of entered Assyriology through that channel. In terms of the current state of Assyriology on the island, we are about to start a course in Akkadian. I will be teaching Akkadian at the university, and I'm trying to promote this study unit to the best of my abilities. I am currently teaching ancient Near Eastern mythology, so I think some of those students will now want to come and do Akkadian. So we're trying to start it off. We're trying to make it popular with students, and we're hoping it will work.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You mentioned at the start that you are very active both in the traditional academic arena, but also in public outreach. I was wondering, in terms of the Maltese audience, what do they find interesting about the ancient Middle East?
Thank you for this question. This is an aspect of my profession that I really enjoy, and this is reaching out to people in the community. Maltese is a Semitic language. So when we talk about Babylonian literature, when we talk about Akkadian, you know, there's always this sort of foreignness to Akkadian and Babylonian literature, for example. But when we talk about these languages being Semitic languages, people start to feel a sense of proximity and a sense of belonging here, right? I have recently started writing about Assyriology in Maltese. And one of the first things that I did for a Maltese literary journal called Afro Confuso with the editors, Loren Vella and Joe Gott, was to address the one and only existing translation of Gilgamesh into Maltese. This is unfortunately translated from the English. And when I looked at it, of course, you realize immediately that it is not a translation from the original, but it's a translation from English. But it was done in a political context when the Maltese were looking for a Semitic identity. And so there is a sort of political layer to this translation about which I have written in this article called Gilgamesh Daklira il-Ih, Gilgamesh, he who saw the deep. When I was doing that, I realized that by translating Gilgamesh for English, we missed out on a lot of the very meaningful proximities between certain Babylonian words and certain words in Maltese. And so now is the time to start thinking about translating Gilgamesh into Maltese from Babylonian. So, you know, through this outreach writing, I think we're starting to get people to realize that you cannot really have a literary scenario in Malta without having a translation of Gilgamesh and some of the other stories that come from the region that interest us.
It is so exciting. What do you think the future of gender studies in the ancient Near East is?
I think I'll be better able to answer this question after the Gender Methodology and Ancient Near East Conference. But I sense that it's definitely a growing community. There are people coming from everywhere, especially young postgraduate students who are sending out correspondence, really interested in building on existing work, particularly those people who come from theory, cultural theory, critical theory, who are interested in bringing those frameworks with them to the study of ancient Near East. Now that we have very good editions of literature, now that we are beginning to have online tools for the study of visual cultures, for example, I think we can safely say that a lot of people are seeing these corpora that are very useful. For example, in my classroom, I have a number of people who are interested in gender and medicine, for example, in gender and magic, but also a number of people who are interested in non-human gender. And I think we are definitely heading in that direction.
Gosh. Thank you very much indeed, Omar.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our patrons, Enrique Jimenez, Jana Matushak, Nancy Highcock, JC, Wood Thrush, Elisa Rosberger, Mark Whedon, Jordi Mung Companies, Thomas Bolin, Joan Porter McEver, John McGuinness, Andrew George, Yelena Rokic, Zach Rubin, Sabina Franke, Shai Gordon, Aaron Max, Maria Sere, Jafar Jothri, Morgan Height, Chicago Watanabe, Mark McElwain, Jonathan Blanchard Smith, Clement Orr, Christina Tsuporopoulou, TT, Melanie Gross, Claire Weir, Mark Feldman, Bruno Biermann, Feynman Roberts, Jason Moser, Pavlo Rosenstein, Mugi Durasutanrova, Willis Munro, Tate Paulette, Toby Wickenden, Emmert Klavenstein, Barbara Porter, Cheryl Morgan, Kevin Roy Jackson, Susanna Paulus, Eric Whittaker, Jakob Fligare, John Ganuza, as well as those who prefer to remain anonymous. I really appreciate your support. It makes a big difference. Every penny received has contributed towards translations. Thanks, of course, to the lovely people who have worked on the translations on a voluntary basis or for well below the market rate. For Arabic, thanks in particular to Zainab Mizudawi, as well as Lina Mirciad and May Alasil. For Turkish, thank you to Penar Durgun and Nesrin Akan. Thin End of the Wedge is still young, but I want to reach a sustainable level where translators are given proper compensation for their hard work. And thank you for listening to Thin End of the Wedge. If you enjoy what we do, and you'd like to help make these podcasts available in Middle Eastern languages, please consider joining our Patreon family. You can find us at patreon.com/wedgepod. You can also support us in other ways. Simply subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Recommend us to your friends. Follow us on Twitter @wedge_pod. If you want the latest podcast news, you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find all the links in the show notes and on our website at wedgepod.org. WEDGEPOD.org. Thanks, and I hope you'll join us next time.